These images showing you the outrage being felt in Tehran as well, where we heard chants of death to America and saw flags being burned. Iran is promising that it will strike back. Now the images on the screen change once again, showing a small, bespectacled individual. This is Majid Takht Ravanchi, Iran's ambassador to the United Nations. "There will be harsh revenge," the diplomat vows. "Iran will act based on its own choosing, and the time, the place, will be decided later on. They should expect anything as a result of this aggression." Footnote: CNN's international and domestic presentations took a sharp turn leftward once Donald Trump was elected president. While he was in office, CNN gained viewers. However, since Mr. Trump departed, the network has lost more than half its audience. End footnote. In Qom, one of Iran's holiest cities, the red flag of revenge is being raised. As the sun ascends on this winter morning, a blood-red standard is being hoisted above the towering dome of Jamkaran Mosque. The words, "Those who want to avenge the blood of Hussein," are written in large white lettering on the flag. Footnote: the words refer to Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. He was decapitated in 680 BC during the Second Islamic Civil War. Many considered his death unjust and responded with brutal attacks on those responsible. Today, the red flag is a call for violent action. End footnote. This mosque is a central location in the Shia religion. The flag on display during the morning call to prayer is normally blue. But as news of Qasem Soleimani's execution becomes widely known throughout Iran, the color of revenge is chosen instead. On Twitter, the hashtag World War III is already trending. 100 miles north in Tehran, the streets are filled with chanting mourners dressed in black. The Ayatollah Khamenei is declaring that severe revenge awaits the United States as 3 days of national grief begin. Soleimani will be buried in his hometown tomorrow, and the Ayatollah will lead the service. Iran is already moving its ballistic missiles in secret, preparing to possibly strike U.S. positions. In Washington, U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham issues a statement confirming his support for the Soleimani assassination, saying he had been briefed about the operation by President Trump in Florida. "We killed the most powerful man in Iran short of the Ayatollah," Graham tweets. "This was not an act of revenge for what he has done in the past. This was a preemptive defensive strike planned to take out the organizer of attacks yet to come." Some Democrats, however, disagree, stating that President Trump did not have the authority to execute Soleimani. "Trump has the ability to prevent an imminent attack against the United States without coming to Congress," Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut stated in an interview with National Public Radio. "I think we need to see if that, in fact, is true. He does not have any other standing authorization to take out a strike against a country that we have not declared war against." Former Vice President Joe Biden, a Democrat now campaigning for the presidency, is also critical of the operation. "While Soleimani deserved to be brought to justice for his crimes against American troops and thousands of innocents throughout the region, the assassination is like throwing dynamite on a tinderbox." Footnote: Joe Biden's record on terrorism is mixed. He originally supported the war in Iraq, ordered by President Bush to eliminate weapons of mass destruction allegedly held by Saddam Hussein. However, Mr. Biden opposed the action that killed Osama bin Laden, but later reversed his position. Today, as president, his posture against Islamic terror is largely undefined. End footnote. The world takes sides. Israel and Saudi Arabia support the assassination. Russia condemns it. The United Nations claims the attack is in violation of its charter, stating that there is no proof Soleimani was planning an attack against Americans. Iraq claims the U.S. action is a blow to its sovereignty. And with every passing day, the world awaits the Iranian response. Turbulence continues. Peace rallies are held around the world. Holding signs demanding that the United States pull its troops from the Middle East, protesters fill Times Square in New York City and stand outside the White House. In all, 80 American cities are the scene of nonviolent protests, and there are others around the globe: London, Berlin, Moscow, Prague, Istanbul. In Baghdad, protesters are unified for the first time in 3 months, demanding the United States exit their country. On the other side, the website for the United States Selective Service System crashes, overwhelmed by young men wishing to know how they might be affected by a potential military draft. Just as in the days after 9/11, when patriotic fervor fueled enlistments, the possibility of war with Iran has stimulated interest in the American armed forces. On January 4, 2020, President Trump holds a press conference at his Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida to defend the attack. "We took action to stop a war. We did not take action to start a war." President Donald Trump tells reporters, "If Americans anywhere are threatened, we have all these targets already fully identified, and I am ready and prepared to take whatever action is necessary, and that in particular refers to Iran." In fact, the United States is already gearing up for conflict. Troops are heading to the Middle East. American warships in the region are on high alert. President Trump set a red line of no U.S. casualties and has warned Tehran not to cross it. He is promising to defend American personnel and interests from Iranian proxies who have already killed Narez Hamid, the U.S. contractor in Iraq. He defends at length the decision to kill Qasem Soleimani, insisting the action was necessary to save American lives. As criticism of Trump and America grows, the president becomes more bellicose. "Let this serve as a warning that if Iran strikes any Americans or American assets, we have targeted 52 Iranian sites, representing the 52 American hostages taken by Iran many years ago, some at a very high level and important to Iran and the Iranian culture, and those targets and Iran itself will be hit very fast and very hard," Trump tweets. Later, Donald Trump ups the rhetoric even more. "They attacked us and we hit back. If they attack again, which I would strongly advise them not to do, we will hit them harder than they have ever been hit before." All the saber-rattling causes the left-wing American media to up the attacks against Donald Trump. The situation quickly becomes political, not one of national security, with CNN leading the dissent. The U.S. has provided few details about those specific threats posed by Soleimani and failed to clearly outline the legal underpinnings, reports the Global Network. The administration has failed to connect the dots in a way that provides a clear picture of an imminent threat, and that argument has been obscured by inconsistent messaging from U.S. officials. One thing that has become relatively clear is that the operation to take out Soleimani did not hinge on some kind of golden opportunity to target the Quds Force commander, unlike the missions that killed Osama bin Laden and ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. Footnote: those statements were made by CNN's Zachary Cohen. He covers the Pentagon as a reporter. His comments, however, are obviously editorial in nature. End footnote. National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien quickly defends the president. "Soleimani was in the Middle East, in Iraq, and traveling around the Middle East. He had just come from Damascus, where he was planning attacks on American soldiers, airmen, Marines, sailors, and against our diplomats," O'Brien states. The National Security Advisor speaks the truth. CIA documents show that captured intelligence pinpointed a number of attacks being planned by Soleimani. But for the media, unfriendly to President Trump, opinion overrode fact. In Tehran, tens of thousands of mourners gather for the funeral of Qasem Soleimani. The words of a weeping Ayatollah Khamenei praying over the general's wooden coffin are broadcast by loudspeakers. An Iranian flag drapes the casket. Then, In a surprise appearance, Soleimani's 27-year-old daughter Zainab is given the chance to speak. She is dressed in black, her head covered by a scarf, but her face visible. Zainab is due to marry Reza Safi al-Din, a Hezbollah leader thought to be the terror organization's second-in-command, this June. Their nuptials portend an even tighter relationship between the Lebanese terror group and Iran. As the funeral grows in intensity, Zainab Soleimani continues. "The families of American soldiers in West Asia," she tells the crowd in a loud, angry tone, "will be waiting for the news of the deaths of their children." Zainab's threat is passionate but confusing. Her speech rambles, but the crowd does not care. The general's daughter inspires them, whipping the mob into a frenzy. Loud chants of death to the USA are heard. Hours after Soleimani's body is put into the ground, Iran launches Operation Martyr Soleimani. Ballistic missiles target a U.S. airbase in Iraq. The attack begins an hour and a half past midnight, roughly the same time Soleimani was assassinated 5 days ago. Iranian Fatah 313 and QAAM short-range missiles, the length of a telephone pole, suddenly rain down on American forces. Cries of "incoming!" send troops racing for the safety of underground bunkers, all the while reeling from the enormous blast waves as Iranian armament explodes less than 30 yards away. The projectiles are deadly, carrying high-explosive warheads weighing almost 1 ton. They are designed to fragment into 1,000 pieces of shrapnel upon striking a target. In the 20-year history of America's war on terror, these are the most powerful weapons ever fired at U.S. forces. The Al-Asad Air Base in northern Iraq is soon a scene of fire and destruction, craters 30 feet wide, incinerated vehicles, and the taste of ammonia-flavored moon dust, in the words of one soldier, referring to explosive residue wafting through the night air. But when the shelling stops and the all-clear finally sounds, Iran is frustrated. No United States troops are killed by the incoming rounds. Footnote: although there were no American fatalities, more than 100 U.S. troops suffered brain injuries and post-traumatic stress disorder due to the percussive effects of missiles landing close to their positions. 29 soldiers were concussed so badly that they received the Purple Heart, an honor only given to soldiers wounded in battle. End footnote. "All is well," President Trump tweets shortly after the attack. The atmosphere in Iran is tense. Nervous soldiers of the Revolutionary Guard, the same troops led and funded by Qasem Soleimani, believe the United States will soon return fire with cruise missiles. But they are mistaken. No missiles are launched by the Trump administration. However, the Iranian military is so jumpy that it reacts impulsively to a strange image on its radar. Incompetent commanders believe it is a cruise missile over Iran. In reality, it is a Ukrainian passenger jet. The 737 is blasted from the sky, killing all 176 passengers and crew on board. The vast majority of passengers are traveling on Iranian passports. Ukraine International Airlines Flight 752 is traveling to Kyiv, the capital of that nation. The action occurs 3 minutes after the jet took off from Tehran. The cockpit is hit first, but flight recorders show the pilots do not die immediately, struggling for 3 minutes to get control of the aircraft. They fail. No one on board survives. One day later, before international investigators comb through the rubble, Iranian bulldozers level the crash scene. The flight data boxes are recovered, but to this day, Iran refuses to share the recordings of Flight 752's final moments. The mullahs initially claim that a fire in one of the aircraft's engines caused the destruction. "It was nothing compared with the main event," Iranian television boasts, referring to the missile attack on Americans. But soon, the clerics admit that human error spurred the launching of two Tor M1 surface-to-air missiles, which ended the lives of the passengers and crew. In essence, General Soleimani has claimed his last victims. Chapter 24. January 12, 2020, White House, Day. President Trump is not through with the mullahs. Less than 2 weeks after the assassination of General Soleimani, the world is now distracted by new events in Iran. Thousands are defying the Iranian government and taking to the streets of Tehran to protest the downing of Flight 752. Iranian public anger, which was once directed at Donald Trump, is now focused on the false story that the Ukrainian aircraft crashed due to mechanical error. The people well understand they have been deceived. And even though the claim has since been changed by the mullahs, there is continuing anger. Protesters are now being arrested. Television journalists reporting on the descent are fired. Elected members of the Iranian parliament, or the Majlis, officially known as the Islamic Consultative Assembly, who support the protesters, are banned by the mullahs from running again. There are also rumors that demonstrators are being shot dead. Inside the White House, President Trump senses weakness. He takes to Twitter. "To the leaders of Iran, do not kill your protesters. Thousands have already been killed or imprisoned by you, and the world is watching. More importantly, the USA is watching. Turn your internet back on and let reporters roam free. Stop the killing of your great Iranian people." The president is still annoyed about the criticism of the Soleimani attack, so he is looking to turn the tables. He is also searching for other terror targets. This is a departure from Donald Trump's usual philosophy in the Middle East. He does not actively support American troops being based on the ground in places like Afghanistan and Iraq. He thinks those countries should fight their own battles. He does not want to spend the money or manpower defending places he believes are not vital to American interests. Nevertheless, the fight against terrorism has become very personal for Mr. Trump. His assessment of his predecessor Barack Obama is that he showed weakness, thereby encouraging terror acts all over the world. Also, President Trump is influenced by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has provided intelligence information indicating that Islamic terrorism is on the rise. And so it is that President Trump has decided to become extremely aggressive in the elimination of known terrorists. And a man named Qasim al-Rimi, a leader of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, is at the top of his list. Al-Rimi's group is not only active in the Middle East, it is responsible for an attempted bombing of a commercial airliner in the United States on Christmas Day 2009. Footnote: Northwest Airlines Flight 253 from Amsterdam to Detroit on Christmas Day 2009 was the subject of a failed attempt to detonate a bomb placed inside a terrorist's underwear. Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, 23, a Nigerian member of al-Qaeda, set fire to the plastic explosives in his pants, but alert fellow passengers wrestled him to the ground and put out the flame before the bomb could detonate. The terrorist was sentenced to 4 life terms in prison and is currently incarcerated in a high-security Supermax facility in Florence, Colorado. End footnote. More infamously, it was AQAP terrorists who stormed into the Paris offices of Charlie Hebdo and slaughtered its employees. In addition, President Trump has a personal motive for wanting al-Rimi dead. Just 3 days after being sworn in as president in 2017, Mr. Trump authorized a mission into Yemen that resulted in the death of a Navy SEAL. And while the Trump administration publicly proclaimed the raid a success, the president still sees that foray as a blemish on his terror record. Chief Petty Officer William Ryan Owens of SEAL Team 6 died in that 2017 raid. 3 years are an eternity, and the mission is all but forgotten. But Donald Trump has not lost the memory. However, he needs an immediate provocation to go after Qasim al-Rimi. He gets one 16 days after the assassination of Qasem Soleimani. The moon is nearly invisible. It is the night of January 29, 2017. The V-22 Osprey tilt-rotor aircraft goes feet dry as it crosses from the Indian Ocean into Yemeni airspace. 10 minutes later, a joint team of Navy SEALs and United Arab Emirates commandos touches down 5 miles outside the village of Al-Ghayil, a reputed terrorist stronghold. Tonight's mission is a sensitive site exploration, SSE, to search for electronics and other sources of information that pinpoint Al-Qaeda forces in Yemen. This data will then be used to launch a quick series of strikes on the terrorists. The SEALs have been in the Middle East for months, undertaking kill or capture operations. A successful strike receives no media coverage and remains top secret. Tonight will not be a successful operation. This mission deep into Yemen was in fact planned years ago. Though the terror threat in Yemen is very real, officials in the Obama administration considered the plan too high risk. The president well remembered a raid he authorized in 2014 to free an American who had been held hostage in Yemen for 15 months. 40 U.S. Army Special Forces operators took part in the action, believing 33-year-old American photographer Luke Summers was in imminent danger, in the words of President Obama. The raid was not a covert operation and included drone strikes, strafing runs by American jets, and the assistance of Yemeni government ground troops. Despite this great show of force, things went wrong. The resulting firefight saw the terrorists kill Summers and fellow hostage Pierre Corky, a South African teacher. President Obama received a great deal of criticism after the raid's failure. With this in mind, he refused to sign off on another attack in Yemen. Footnote: Summers was alive when American special forces finally neutralized the terrorists. He was flown to the USS Macon Island, where he died in surgery. Corky was killed during the firefight. End footnote. But new Secretary of Defense James Mattis sees things differently. He believes the plan against Al-Qaeda has the potential for a very substantial payoff. The desert location has been monitored closely by drones and satellites for months and appears to be lightly defended. Over dinner at the White House just 4 days ago, Secretary Mattis aggressively lobbied President Trump to formally authorize the mission. Footnote: also present were Vice President Pence, National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff General Joseph Dunford, CIA Director Mike Pompeo, Presidential Strategist Steve Bannon, and Mr. Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner. End footnote. At the very least, Mattis believes the raid will capture sensitive information. But there's also the chance that Al-Qaeda leaders may be on site, in particular, Qasem al-Rimi. Born in Yemen 38 years ago, the terrorist's career dates to the 1990s when he served with Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan. An average-looking man, al-Rimi is a fanatic and has been on a list of the world's most wanted terror suspects since 2011. He is responsible for bombing hospitals and killing innocent tourists. Secretary Mattis reminds President Trump that this sensitive site exploration offers him a chance to differentiate himself from his predecessor by taking a bold risk. The general believes the raid on Al-Ghayil could be a game changer. The next morning, Mr. Trump signs what is known as the Execute Order, XORD, giving the go-ahead. Within hours, Navy SEALs and counterparts from the UAE are flown to the amphibious ship USS Macon Island. The ship will serve as a quick reaction force site if the raid runs into trouble, launching aircraft and helicopters to assist the special forces personnel inside Yemen. More than 2,000 Marines are on board, prepared to go into battle as a backup force. On the night of January 29, 2017, the teams are flown from the Macon Island by V-22 Ospreys and dropped at a position 5 miles from the known terrorist location. The flight is a short 15 minutes. Al-Ghail is a series of stone homes and buildings atop a rugged mountaintop. The land is windswept and treeless, a barren desert fortress. As the commandos walk quietly uphill toward the village in almost complete darkness, drones pick up intense movement from inside some houses. Night vision cameras record images of Al-Qaeda fighters taking up positions. Despite every attempt at stealth, the terrorists know the SEALs are coming. The raid has been compromised. To this day, it is not known how Al-Qaeda received this information. Yet despite the new risk, the commandos press on, determined to complete the mission. Their opponents are not disorganized fighters. Each of the terrorists has spent months learning military tactics at training camps in Afghanistan and Iran. They have prepared their positions well in advance. They take cover in homes, a medical clinic, even a mosque. The ground is mined. And the terrorist soldiers are not just men. Even the wives of the Al-Qaeda fighters are armed and dangerous. As the 36 elite troops approach Al-Ghail, heavy fire breaks out. The SEALs and their UAE counterparts are pinned down. They cannot know the size of the force arrayed against them. The fighters have no choice but to call for help. Out in the Indian Ocean, the alert sounds aboard the USS Macon Island. The quick reaction force is launched. American fighter aircraft and helicopter gunships race to the battlefield and pour down fire on Al-Qaeda positions. The village of Al-Ghail is leveled, and 14 Al-Qaeda fighters are killed. But the mission is not a success. Despite efforts to prevent the loss of civilian lives, 16 children are killed, 10 of them under the age of 13. SEAL Team 6 collects no electronics or other documents. An Osprey is sent to extract those SEAL teams. The damaged aircraft is intentionally destroyed so that its onboard technology does not fall into terrorist hands. Several American troops are wounded. Chief Petty Officer William Ryan Owens, a Navy SEAL and married father of three, is killed when a bullet strikes him in the torso just inches above his protective body armor. Footnote: William Ryan Owens was a longtime Navy SEAL operator. His father, Bill Owens, a former Green Beret, turned down a meeting with President Trump when his son's body was returned to America and demanded an investigation into what he called a stupid mission. End footnote. And despite all the effort, there is absolutely no sign of Qasim al-Rimi. Back in Washington, White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer quickly calls the mission a very successful raid, but Arizona Senator John McCain publicly disagrees. When you lose a $75 million airplane and, more importantly, an American, life is lost and there are wounded, I don't believe that you can call it a success, says McCain, the powerful chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. President Trump appears on the television show Fox and Friends soon afterward to offer his side of the story. Well, this was a mission that was started before I got here. This was something that was, you know, they wanted to do. The botched terror raid in President Trump's first week in office results in enormous criticism. Mr. Trump never forgets that he was thwarted by fighters loyal to Qasim al-Rimi. A bounty of $10 million is quickly placed on al-Rimi's head. The terrorist is not impressed. A week after the failed raid, al-Rimi openly taunts President Trump in an 11-minute Al-Qaeda video. The new fool of the White House received a painful slap across his face, the terrorist crows. It is almost 3 years later, January 18, 2020. The Muslim call to prayer echoes over the Al-Estibal military camp in the village of Marib, Yemen. It is almost dark as soldiers in uniform file in and kneel on their prayer mats. Their nation is engaged in a war with the Houthi rebels, a Shia terrorist movement sponsored by Iran. Qasim al-Rimi is not part of the Houthi organization, but helps it in order to secure a remote hiding place for his organization. Al-Rimi knows he is being hunted. In 2019, his group publicly supported a terror attack inside the United States when a gunman opened fire on pilots in training at Naval Air Station Pensacola in Florida. Three servicemen were killed, two sheriff's deputies wounded. Al-Rimi calls the Al-Qaeda killer a courageous knight. As the government troops continue their prayer service, a missile slams into the mosque. Instantly, 111 Yemeni soldiers die. In this moment, the world of terrorism changes. As the mosque implodes from the explosion, confusion about the source of the attack follows. There was no suicide bomber exploding a vest. No one drove a car into the building. And there was no sound of artillery or a mortar round. The only possible explanation is that someone launched a drone strike. America is immediately suspected. But that makes no sense. Under President Trump, the United States has reduced its presence in Yemen. In 2017, his first year in office, 131 airstrikes were launched by American jets in Yemen. In 2018, there were just 36. In 2019, only 6. Secretly, Donald Trump has upped the ante in the war on terror. But striking Yemeni soldiers is not on his list because they are actually fighting Islamic terrorists. As for the destruction of the mosque in Marib, no one takes responsibility. The mystery deepens. But soon, U.S. and Israeli intelligence see the fingerprints of Iran. On June 20, 2019, the Iranians shot down an American Global Hawk drone over the Strait of Hormuz, using surface-to-air missiles. In addition, they are the only country in the region to have drone capability. The White House is quickly informed that Iran now has the weaponry to strike American troops in the Middle East at any time. Also, in the hands of a terrorist like Qasem Al-Rimi, an unmanned aerial drone could be flown almost anywhere to commit an act of terror. It is clear Al-Rimi is a very dangerous person. Thus, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo issues a statement shortly after the mosque attack, stating that such mayhem produces instability that terrorist groups and other malignant actors can exploit for their own purposes. So with Iran and Al-Qaeda working together in Yemen, President Trump has a decision to make. It comes quickly. The date is January 25th, just 1 week after the Marib mosque attack. The time is 11 a.m. At a house in the Joe Nassim area of Marib, the Saturday morning is uneventful. That is, until a Hellfire missile fired by an American drone destroys the home and kills its occupant. To this day, his name and status within Al-Qaeda is unknown. 2 days later, in the Al-Hazma area, another hellfire destroys another house. This one leaves behind the charred body of an individual named Abdullah Al-Adani. 3 hours after the attack, an Al-Qaeda crew comes to remove the body for identification. Footnote: Abdullah Al-Adani was a nom de guerre for a lower-level Al-Qaeda official. It is thought he may have been waiting for Al-Rimi's arrival at the time of his death. End footnote. But once again, Qasem Al-Rimi survives. The terrorist then goes quiet, correctly believing the drone strikes are aimed at him. Al-Rimi's continuing ability to evade death is considered remarkable by his trackers. Until things change. On January 29th, in the village of Al-Hosn al-Mashrif, a car bearing two men rolls through a Houthi roadblock heading for a small house. The men depart the vehicle. They step inside. Within an instant, an explosion shatters the midday calm. Both men die instantly, casualties of two drone rockets. One of the men is Abu al-Bara al-Ibi, a senior Al-Qaeda official. The other man is Qasem Al-Rimi. President Trump does not announce the assassination. In fact, it is several days before confirmation of the mission is made public. It is left to the State Department to make the official statement. At the direction of President Trump, the U.S. conducted a counterterrorism operation in Yemen that successfully eliminated Qasem al-Rimi, a founder and the leader of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and a deputy to al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri. Footnote: the 70-year-old al-Zawahiri succeeded Osama bin Laden as worldwide leader of al-Qaeda in 2011. The Egyptian physician is widely considered the planner of the 9/11 attacks and is now in hiding with a $25 million U.S. bounty on his head. He is currently the most wanted terrorist in the world. End footnote. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is gone. Qasem Soleimani is gone. Qasem al-Rimi is gone. But the war on terror remains. However, it is now shifting to a new battlefield. Chapter 25. November 8, 2020, Muatid, Mozambique. Day. The victims can see the end of their lives. 3,000 miles south of the Middle East, Islamic State terror reigns. Today is Sunday. Smoke fills the air from the many local homes burned by ISIS terrorists over the last 3 days. Young African men who have sworn loyalty to the Islamic State herd local villagers onto the town's small football pitch. The terrorists carry machetes and wear automatic weapons slung around their necks. The playing surface is red dirt instead of grass. Dead bodies litter midfield, all murdered by ISIS killers who are now yelling Allahu Akbar and firing shots into the air. The infidels being herded are boys and men who have refused to join the Islamic State. Many ran into the woods outside of town when the terrorists began raiding Muatid 3 days ago. But the killers have been thorough, searching the forests and rounding up victims one by one. Some men are shot immediately, left to die in the trees along the Luria River. Their wives and daughters have been allowed to live, forced to serve as sex slaves. The men now kneeling on the dirt soccer field can see for themselves the barbaric fate that awaits them. For the dead bodies of their friends are not in one piece. Heads are missing, arms and legs hacked off. Torsos have been chopped into small pieces. Carrion birds are now feasting on the entrails. The infidels have a choice to make. They can join ISIS and live, or they will suffer a slow beheading with a dull machete, one which might require several blows to do the job. However, should these men choose to join ISIS, they must prove their loyalty through a simple initiation rite, accept the machete, and perform the beheading and dismemberment of a fellow villager. It seems useless to resist. ISIS now controls a growing African caliphate. Their extremist Muslim faith is modeled upon that of fighters in the Middle East. Even tourists caught in their sweep through southern Africa are beheaded. By the time the terrorists depart Muatid tomorrow, 50 local men and boys will be hacked to pieces. Local women will emerge from hiding and sort through the corpses, collecting the body parts of loved ones for burial. But the Islamic State will never be far away. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi has been dead a year, but his followers are worse than ever. The world may be watching the Middle East, but Africa is now the new home of terror. Savage death is nothing new to the people of Africa, where the terror group known as Boko Haram is a deadly menace. Once loyal to al-Qaeda, BH terrorists defected after the death of Osama bin Laden. The militants now swear allegiance to ISIS and are committing atrocities in a number of countries. Footnote: correspondence between Boko Haram and Osama bin Laden was among the documents removed from the al-Qaeda leader's compound after his assassination. The switchover to ISIS took place in March 2015, with Boko Haram leader Abu Bakr Shekau sending a videotape to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi swearing his loyalty to the Islamic State. ISIS quickly responded, claiming West Africa as part of their caliphate. End footnote. In 2014, 2,000 miles northwest of Mozambique, Boko Haram begins the most murderous year in terrorist history. The date is February 25th. It is 2 a.m. in the town of Buniyadi, Nigeria. Students at the Federal Government College are asleep in single-story yellow buildings with black roofs. All are between the ages of 11 and 18. No one stirs as the terrorists emerge from their hideout in the thick Sambisa forest and take up positions. Boko Haram is dedicated to its own version of Islamic purity and seeks to eradicate other faiths as well as rival Muslim sects. Its terrorists now creep out of the darkness and surround the college. There are 24 buildings in all. Some attackers dress in Middle Eastern fashion, wearing flowing robes and keffiyeh head coverings. Others wear battlefield camouflage with extra ammunition strapped to their chests. Their weapon of choice is usually the AK-47 rifle, although tonight they prefer flame. The name Boko Haram means Western education is sinful. The group believes that reading any book other than the Quran is a violation of Sharia law. Its goal is to create an Islamic state in Nigeria. Its adherents have killed thousands and displaced an estimated 2 million Africans to make that a reality. No atrocity is too much. Terrorists strap bombs to little girls, sending them into public markets to kill themselves and others. In fact, a U.S. Congressional Subcommittee on Terrorism will note, in 2014, Boko Haram killed nearly 7,000 people. Murdered is a better word than killed, making them the deadliest terrorist group in the world, even surpassing ISIS. The brutal Islamists have attacked more than 200 schools all throughout Africa. These soft targets are chosen because Boko Haram believes they spread Western philosophy, and also because schools are unguarded. 6 months ago, in a shocking mass murder, Boko Haram fanatics crept into the dormitories of an agricultural college and opened fire, murdering 40 sleeping students. 2 months before that, in July, the group attacked a dormitory in the town of Mamudo, Nigeria, killing 41 young college students with grenades and machine guns. Footnote: American and European news consumers rarely see video of Boko Haram's atrocities because it is too dangerous for photographers to track the group. End footnote. But tonight will be far worse in Buniyadi. The attackers surround the dormitories. Working quickly, they throw grenades into the rooms and set fire to those buildings housing male students. Phone lines have already been cut, so there is no chance Nigerian government soldiers can be summoned. As flames consume the dorms, students throw open doors and windows and try to make a run for it. Most are cut down. Several terrorists fire at once, ensuring that each victim has multiple gunshot wounds. Throats are then slit. Boko Haram is in no hurry. As the night sky is lit by fire, terrorists watch the dormitories burn. Dozens of dead male students lie in the dirt parking lot, puddles of blood forming around them. Others die in their beds, many burned to ashes. By sunrise, all 24 buildings comprising the college will be destroyed. 59 male students are murdered. Approximately 50 female students are captured. Executions are reserved for the boys. Radical Islam is a patriarchal society that values masculine authority and the subjugation of women. So instead of being killed, the girls are ordered to return to their villages to marry. Should the young ladies fail to do that, Boko Haram reminds them of the brutality that will happen. 2 months later, on the night of April 14, 2014, the terrorists keep their promise. The world will simply call them our girls. Boko Haram prefers to call them sex slaves. Another night, another school. Boko Haram fighters surround the government girls' secondary school in the northern Nigerian town of Chibok. The raid takes place under a bright half-moon instead of total darkness. The girls are Christians, which could result in grave consequences if they are taken captive. This is not a surprise attack. The phone lines are not cut. Nigerians from miles away have been calling the school all evening, warning that caravans of heavily armed Boko Haram fighters are filling the roads, most likely headed for the girls. Due to the terror threat, schools throughout the region have been closed. But now is the time for final examinations. The secondary school has been shut for weeks, but reopened so that students can take their tests. All the girls are between 16 and 18 and in their last year of secondary education. Boko Haram knows this and sees the chance to score a decisive victory. The government of Nigeria has adopted a tactic of arresting family members of Boko Haram leadership in an attempt to bring the band to heel. Since you are now holding our women, just wait and see what will happen to your own women, terror leader Abubakar Shekau has announced. The threat on the girls' school is payback. However, a small force of Nigerian soldiers is waiting for the Boko Haram vehicles. Both sides are weaponized, armed with grenade launchers and automatic machine guns. Confusingly, the terrorists are wearing stolen government military uniforms tonight, making it difficult to distinguish between the two sides. The battle rages for 5 hours, but the Nigerian government refuses to send reinforcements. The terrorists eventually overrun the soldiers and descend upon the school shouting Allahu Akbar and We are Boko Haram. The frightened girls are rounded up. A terrorist leader makes an announcement. If you want to die, sit down here. We will kill you. If you don't want to die, you will enter the trucks. Sobbing, 276 young women choose to live. They board the trucks, allowing themselves to be taken prisoner. There are so many girls that some are forced to walk for several miles until other trucks can be brought in to carry them. A fortunate 53 girls seize an opportunity to slip away. They will testify to the abductions. Quickly, there is international pressure to find our girls. The United States and Britain take the extraordinary step of flying manned aerial patrols over the thick jungle along the border of Chad and Nigeria, where the girls are thought to have been taken. The Nigerian government seeks to defuse the worldwide outrage by claiming all the female students are safe and on their way home. This is a lie. No act of terror committed by Boko Haram before or since the kidnapping has brought the terror organization as much publicity. Despite the best efforts of satellite and drone technology, the girls simply vanish. On May 5th, 3 weeks after the raid, Boko Haram leader Abubakar Shekau makes a chilling video announcement. Allah instructed me to sell them, the middle-aged terrorist proclaims. He is a thick-set man with a long beard. Shekau is rarely seen without his camouflaged uniform and automatic weapon. He continues, I will carry out his instructions. The abducted girls are forced to convert to Islam, then sold as brides. The price is just $4 for a member of Boko Haram. For the men of nearby Chad and Cameroon who cross the border, the price is $12. For a time, Shekau is among the most famous terror leaders in the world, achieving the sort of notoriety once enjoyed by Abubakar al-Baghdadi. But soon, Boko Haram splinters as a result of intramural fighting. The faction that wins the civil war is called the Islamic State West African Province, or ISWAP. Footnote: Abubakar Shekau did not survive the terrorist civil war. On May 19, 2021, he exploded his suicide vest as he was being surrounded by ISWAP fighters in a jungle encampment. End footnote. With little control over vast expanse of jungle, most African governments cannot defeat Boko Haram on their own. But because of the untapped mineral wealth of Africa, the world's superpowers are now getting involved. Armies of the United States, China and Russia are on the ground, monitoring the terrorist situation. American Special Operations Forces comprised of U.S. Navy SEALs, U.S. Army Green Berets, and U.S. Marine Corps Raiders operate covertly in 22 African nations. Footnote: Algeria, Botswana, Burkina Faso, Cameroon, Cape Verde, Chad, Côte d'Ivoire, Djibouti, Egypt, Ethiopia, Ghana, Kenya, Libya, Madagascar, Mali, Mauritania, Niger, Nigeria, Senegal, Somalia, Tanzania, and Tunisia. End footnote. The American presence in Africa is largely kept secret, but these warriors serve at the invitation of African governments. The U.S. mission is to advise, assist, and accompany, AAA, African soldiers to combat the Islamic State and Boko Haram, which are now operating together. Footnote: Despite the high level of terror activity in Africa, the number of American soldiers is much greater in other parts of the world. There are 6,000 U.S. troops in all of Africa, as compared to 40,000 in Japan, 35,000 in Germany, and 25,000 in South Korea. End footnote. These shadow campaigns are not without peril. It is exceedingly dangerous to operate in territory not under government control. That's what happens in 2017 when Navy SEAL Kyle Milliken, a 38-year-old senior chief petty officer, is killed while on an AAA mission in Somalia, shot dead by the militant Islamist group Al-Shabaab. The fact is that U.S. special forces are now being directed to the most dangerous places on Earth, like Niger. Tourists do not vacation in Niger. The landlocked nation is twice the size of Texas, but offers no big cities and very few conveniences. Niger is considered the poorest country in the world by the United Nations. Few of its citizens can read or write. French is the national language, but the people more often speak in tribal dialects. The terrain is arid and sprawling, suitable for subsistence farming, but offering no prospect of industry to the population of 16 million. Footnote: The United Nations Human Development Index ranks nations on the basis of life expectancy, education, literacy, and per capita income. Niger finished 189th out of the 189 countries surveyed in 2018 and 2019. End footnote. Most notably, the former French colony has been independent for 60 years, but is unable to establish a democratic system of government and is now under military rule. But rule is an arbitrary term. Niger is a lawless haven for smugglers and terrorists. No one is in charge. Guns rule. The date is October 4, 2017. 11 members of the U.S. 3rd Special Forces Group, known as Team 3212, stop in the village of Tongo Tongo in western Niger. These Green Berets are still new to the area, joining the 800 Americans on the hunt for Islamic terrorists. Niger is infested with militant factions. ISIS controls land to the north, Al-Qaeda owns territory to the west, and Boko Haram has a powerful presence to the south and southeast. This is one of the most hostile regions on the planet, with 46 terror attacks in the last 20 months. Special Forces Team 3212 is exhausted, having stayed up almost all night. They travel in three vehicles, a Toyota Land Cruiser and two four-wheel drive pickup trucks. Two machine guns are mounted in the pickups. They are called technicals. Also on patrol with the Americans is a 30-man group of soldiers from the Nigerian Army who travel in five large trucks, one of which was provided by the Central Intelligence Agency. At first, the mission is routine, starting out as a day-long journey to meet local tribal leaders in a show of goodwill. But when that job is complete and the team is on its way back to base, it is suddenly diverted. A raid on the hideout of a known Islamic State commander is in motion. A team of American commandos is being flown several hundred miles by helicopter to lead the attack. The French Air Force will provide cover. Team 3212 is charged with backing up the operation. American intelligence has intercepted a phone call from a local ISIS leader named Dondon Shefu. He is a suspect in the kidnapping of American aid worker Jeffrey Woodke in October 2016. Shefu is known for raiding into Niger with his group, then retreating back across the border into Mali, where he hides in a dense forest. This is an opportunity to arrest Shefu and maybe bring Woodke home. Footnote: Woodke, 59, is still in captivity as of this writing. The government of Niger believes he is alive. End footnote. The Green Berets are told that Shefu is a TST, time-sensitive target. Speed is vital. But the weather does not cooperate. Dusty winds cancel the helicopter insertion before the commando strike team ever leaves the ground. The French air support is also scrubbed. Yet the mission is not canceled. The lightly armed Green Beret and Nigerian force will conduct the search alone. The Americans take a short nap, sleeping until 2 a.m., then approaching the ISIS camp in darkness. Team 3212 enters the location cautiously, checking for jihadis hiding in the forest and rocks. The camp is abandoned. Just a camouflage uniform, spent shell casings, leftover rations of tea and sugar, and a motorcycle are found. Ominously, the tracks of other motorcycles can be seen leading away from the location. But no jihadis. Just as well. Though trained to execute an attack on a terror compound, the Green Berets and their Nigerian counterparts are not equipped to confront a large terrorist presence. Most of the Americans carry M4 carbines, while the Nigerians are armed with medium machine guns. The vehicles are not bulletproof, and the teams are not armed with heavy weapons such as mortars. The original mission was supposed to be so low-key that only one American soldier thought to bring along a grenade launcher. It is clear that the ISIS fighters who once lived in the camp are much better armed. With a sense of relief after seeing no targets, the team begins the journey back to base, 100 miles away. The stop in Tongo Tongo, a hamlet on the borderlands of Niger and Mali, is meant to be brief. The plan is to eat breakfast, refill hydration bladders from the village well, meet with local leaders, and then return to base near the town of Kualam. When the local chief says some of the village children are sick, the Green Berets offer medicine. The Nigerian soldiers are relaxed, taking their time to eat. They have previously visited Tongo Tongo 19 times, never once having an issue with the local population. This calms the weary Americans, still learning the ways of Niger. The time is 10:30 a.m. But unbeknownst to the Americans, Islamic State fighters have been tipped off about their location. Terrorists wielding automatic weapons race toward Tongo Tongo to set up an ambush. They travel in a caravan of more than a dozen technical vehicles and 20 motorcycles, speaking openly of decapitating any Americans they find. There are about 50 of the jihadis, a strong force. They stop 100 yards outside of town and take up positions in the woods lining both sides of the road. Inside Tongo Tongo, the Americans grow suspicious. Their meeting with the local chieftains was meant to last 30 minutes, but has now lasted almost an hour. In fact, the chief's cell phone contains the phone number for Dondon Shefu, and the two men are in touch, but the Green Berets don't know that. They do see young men from the village driving out of town on their motorcycles for no apparent reason. The Americans sense a setup and quickly end the meeting. Along with the Nigerian soldiers, they enter their vehicles and drive out of town in a single-file line. Home base is 90 miles away. The time is 11:35 a.m. The Green Berets are cautious. The Sahel Desert in the Tillaberi region of Niger is almost without vegetation, but the land just outside Tongo Tongo marks the beginning of a wide forest of scrub and small trees. The road is dirt, the terrain thickly wooded. The Americans keep eyes left where the trees are thickest, watching for signs of terrorist movement. They don't have to wait long. After 30 seconds of driving, the convoy takes fire. The ambush comes from the left, as predicted. A deafening volley of automatic weapons fire strikes the convoy. Rocket-propelled grenades fill the air. The soldiers exit their vehicles and return fire. The team's commander, Captain Mike Perazzini, is hit and wounded. Radio operator Sergeant First Class Brent Bartels is also struck by gunfire, but not before sending a message to base that the Green Berets are under fire. The battle rages. ISIS fighters can be seen trying to surround the American force. The Green Berets and their allies return to their vehicles to make a run for it. The fight is now 25 minutes old, and the time is just after noon. A red smoke grenade is thrown to conceal the retreat. One by one, the American vehicles egress at a high rate of speed. But in the chaos, three Green Berets are left behind. Staff Sergeants Dustin Wright, Jeremiah Johnson, and Brian Black are pinned down, taking cover behind their black SUV. Wright is a former football player from the small town of Santa Claus, Georgia. Johnson is a specialist in chemical warfare from Springboro, Ohio. Sergeant Black is a nationally ranked chess player from Washington State who actually planned his own memorial service before going to Africa, just in case, asking that the Irish folk song Finnegan's Wake be played. All three soldiers now work together to survive, determined not to die on the desolate desert sands of Niger. Sergeant Wright drives while the other two jog along the far side, shielded from terrorist gunfire. Every man wears a helmet cam, so the events soon to play out will be clearly visible. The dust, sound of gunfire, and hand signals are recorded. Help is on the way. Realizing their mistake after making a successful exit, the other Green Berets return to the battlefield. But though they kill more than